We are going to hear the case of Tolliver v. McCautry. Mr. Gansner.
Good afternoon, and may it please the Court. We meet once again in this case. This Court previously ruled that the decision of the magistrate judge in the Eastern District of Wisconsin should be turned for further proceedings, two discrete inquiries. First, this court disagreed with the district court that the defendant disagreed with the district court's conclusion that the defendant had failed to prove, failed to demonstrate prejudice under Strickland v. Washington with respect to his ineffective assistance of counsel claims with respect to two witnesses whose testimony was not presented by the defense attorney at Mr. Tolliver's trial in 1990. But because the state courts had never ruled on the question of deficient performance, and there had been no consideration of that matter in the district court, this court remanded the matter to the district court for inquiry on whether or not counsel's performance was deficient. Secondly, this court ruled that factual determination needed to be made with respect to the defendant's Brady v. Maryland claim that a letter of a material exculpatory nature, if the letter in fact existed and had been received. The defendant's claim was that the state had failed to turn over this information. There had been an unresolved question in the state courts, and that remained unresolved at the district court level, as to whether or not that information in the form of a letter allegedly sent by a prisoner to the prosecutor in Mr. Tolliver's case had in fact been sent and ever been received, and thus was there any basis for a claim that the state had failed to disclose the information in the letter, failed to disclose the information which this court concluded when the case was here before appeared to be material and exculpatory. So the case went back to the district court for that determination. We are back here again on the state of Wisconsin's appeal from so much of the magistrate judge's decision on behalf of the district court, finding after further inquiry that the performance of the trial counsel in the case, who died many years before this case came before, a number of years before this case came before the court, apparently sometime prior to June of 2000,
Yesterday, forgive me for interrupting, but you don't have a lot of time. Yesterday, Mr. Tolliver's counsel submitted a letter stating that the Supreme Court's decision in Lafler indicates that Harrington did not, in fact, alter the AEDPA standards. How do you respond?
We believe that Mr. Mullins, my opponent, has, I believe, mischaracterized the decision and the effect of the decision in Lafler. I believe that this court appropriately determined in its earlier decision in Price versus Thurmer that Harrington versus Richter, as I believe a number of other courts have subsequently recognized, did make a significantly strong statement about the deference that must be given to a state court's determinations by a federal habeas court under the AEDPA. As this court recognized in Price versus Thurmer, that the Supreme Court's decision in Harrington made clear, with what this court characterized as rather unexpected vigor, that it was the obligation of a federal district court
to give great deference. How does that bear on the issue of representation, adequacy of representation?
Your Honor, with all due respect to what this court previously ruled with respect to the question of prejudice in this case. We have asked for this, that this court, we've respectfully requested that this court, with Harrington versus Richter having been decided since this case was here previously, that this court consider anew.
You're not answering my question. I don't see what Harrington has to do with the question of what to do with the fact that the lawyer being dead, it's extremely difficult to, in fact, it seems to be impossible to figure out what his reason was for not calling the wife and cousin as witnesses.
No, I think Harrington versus Richter, Your Honor, I don't believe it really does go to the matter that never was considered.
Isn't that our issue, though?
Well,
whether there was
deficient performance.
Right.
Yes, that is the question. We have also asked, however, in light of Harrington versus Richter, that since a determination of both prejudice and deficient performance must both be made in order for there to be a finding that effective representation was denied, that this court, in light of Harrington versus Richter, take this opportunity to reconsider its previous view on the question of prejudice. Harrington versus Richter, we acknowledge, Your Honor, does not apply in any significant fashion, if at all, to the question of consideration of deficient performance, since there was no ruling in the state courts of Wisconsin on the question of deficient performance. So Harrington versus Richter's mandate that the federal courts apply great deference to matters, state court resolution of issues that were resolved on the merits by the state court, really doesn't apply to the deficient performance.
But was Harrington and Richter about adequacy of representation?
They were.
I thought it was about the adequacy of the evidence of his guilt.
Well, with respect to Harrington, yes. With respect to, I'm sorry, Your Honor, I thought you were asking about Lafler.
No, I'm asking about Harrington.
Okay. No, Harrington was a case that did go to the question of the adequacy of evidence.
Right.
With respect to medical experts' evidence.
So I don't see how it bears on the question of the performance of the lawyer.
No, I agree. I do not believe that Harrington applies to, and we are not asking for this court to consider the question of the application of Harrington's deference to the question of deficient performance, because there never was a determination.
Then
by
to
this,
what?
There never was a determination.
Why are we applying it?
We've asked, the first issue that we have raised and the first argument that we have made in our briefing before this court was that this court take this opportunity to reconsider its previous ruling on the matter of prejudice in this case, and that it apply to that, open that question anew, and consider, under the Supreme Court's decision in Harrington versus Richter, whether or not its previous decision finding that the failure of counsel to introduce testimony from these two witnesses was prejudicial. The state courts, of course, had consistently held that it was not. And in our view, since at least four, in the words of Harrington, four fair-minded jurists in the state of Wisconsin have rendered a view on prejudice that we believe is one that reasonable jurists could render in finding that there was no prejudice in this case, we're asking that this court, in light of the clearly controlling decision in Harrington versus Richter and its pronouncement, as this court has indicated, the vigor with which it announced deference must be shown to the state court's determination on issues, constitutional issues, on which they have reached the merits, that this court, we are asking that this court reopen the question of prejudice and look at it anew. We acknowledge, and I don't mean to create any confusion whatsoever, Harrington does not apply to the question of deficient performance. On the question of deficient performance, it is our view that the defendant did not, as a matter of his responsibility under Strickland versus Washington, discharge his burden of showing that trial counsel engaged in unprofessional and deficient performance in not interviewing one of two people and in not presenting the testimony of.
What is the reason why he didn't put on the wife as a witness and investigate the or talk to the cousin?
We are left, as I believe the district court was left in a position to do, to, in essence, speculate, because there was no evidence. There was an inquiry years ago, before the death of trial counsel, when the defendant was representing himself, that related to a matter that is not being raised by Mr. Tolliver now, with respect to whether another person's testimony wasn't presented.
Evidence in the sense that not putting the wife on seems odd. I mean, odd to see what you would lose. And not talking to the cousin doesn't seem to do anything, to have any reason. So isn't there some burden of production on the state to show that there may indeed have been legitimate strategic reasons for what he did?
Well, in the first instance, Your Honor, I believe that Strickland makes clear that the burden...
Now, just being realistic, if you have circumstances which certainly looks like inadequate representation, setting aside the prejudice issue for a second, then you'd say, well, as in any case, we have a lot of evidence on one side. The burden of production shifts to the other party to put on some evidence to show that, you know, like... a discussion of everything that went on at the trial, which would show that he had other witnesses or other evidence, or the state's evidence was weak, and therefore putting on a questionable witness because of the relationship would actually have weakened his case. Is there anything like that?
Well, in fact, I believe what we have in this case, Your Honor, is something the converse of what you have just suggested. We had a case where I believe it is fair to conclude that the state's case was sufficiently strong that the defense believed that putting on witnesses whose bias might well result in their testimony simply being disregarded as a futile act.
Depends what other witnesses he had. Did he have any other witnesses?
Well, the defendant himself was the principal witness who opted.
Did he have other witnesses?
Oh, there were other defense witnesses who testified, yes. And there was some question. This was not a one-sided affair. The principal witness relied upon by the defense was the defendant himself. But I think this is a case in which,
who were his other witnesses?
Well, Your Honor, I don't have a complete listing of all of them here.
There. Example of another witness.
Well, there were. Much of the testimony came in through a very strenuous or vigorous cross-examination of prosecution witnesses by the defense.
Yeah, that's not what I'm asking. I'm asking about his witnesses.
Well, it was principally the defendant.
Why you keep saying that? Principally implies there are others.
I'm sorry, Your Honor, I cannot provide you...
Were there others, or are you just talking about cross-examination of prosecution witnesses?
I cannot name or list for you all of the witnesses that the defense produced.
You know, can we really say that it was a strategic decision when a 10-minute phone conversation with Harvey would have told the attorney much of what he needed to know in terms of whether Harvey would be an okay witness or not? I mean, I kept wondering into what other resources, just like Judge Posner is asking you, into what other resources might counsel have been putting all of his efforts into so that he couldn't even interview Harvey Tolliver over the telephone. It just boggles the mind to say that that was a strategic decision.
Fair enough question. The question nonetheless remains, what do we do in a situation where we are deprived by virtue of the death of the one person who can provide
genuine
information?
Well, didn't he leave any files? Now, I gather this lawyer who testified at the new evidentiary hearing He said he couldn't make a judgment without the files.
Your Honor, there was no lawyer who testified at the new evidence hearing.
No, but there was someone who yes. said he wouldn't testify because he didn't have access to the files.
Right.
That's what I'm asking about. Now, where are those files? No files? They vanished?
I'm dependent upon counsel for the petitioner in this case to tell us what he can about the files, what did happen in the case, Your Honor, and I think this is critical that this be clearly understood. In the course of the preparation for the evidence you're hearing below, petitioner's counsel asked for and received a considerable extension of time in the scheduling of the evidence you're hearing so that he could arrange to have another lawyer, which he wished to have review the transcripts of Mr. Tolliver's case, just as this court and the state courts reviewed the transcripts, and offer his opinion.
What I'm talking about.
After a substantial...
Now, I'm asking you, where are the files?
Mr. Mullins is going to have to answer that question because the state has no access to the files of and has no knowledge of the whereabouts of the files of long-dead defense attorney. The point I wanted to stress, however, was that having asked for an opportunity to have an outside attorney
yes,
expert...
Yes, we know that, but
it
the...
never happened.
Because there are no files, he didn't feel he could offer an opinion without the files.
Well, I would merely point out to some extent...
You for the absence of the files?
Well, the state certainly isn't responsible for it, but that put the petitioner in this case in no different a position than both the Wisconsin courts and the federal courts have been in this case in attempting to assess the performance of counsel, that we are operating simply on the basis of transcripts of testimony.
Okay.
And in this case, no opinion was ever offered
right.
by the petitioner on that question.
Thank you, Mr. Gass.
Thank you.
Mr. Mullins?
May it please the Court, my name is Brian Mullins, and I represent the appellee Stephen Tolliver in this case. To address the Court's question on the location of the files, we do not know where they are. We attempted to find the files. Mr. Keegan, who was the trial lawyer, was a solo practitioner, and he died in 1997. We were able to identify his wife. We called her, and were not able to communicate with her. And we also contacted the state public defender, Milwaukee County State Public Defender, because Mr. Keegan was appointed by the state public defender's office to represent Mr. Tolliver. The state public defender indicated that they did not keep files that far back. This was a 1992 trial, and you know, at that point there were no computer records and such. So the file is not available, unfortunately. We do have what I believe the best evidence of what Mr. Keegan was thinking, the best contemporaneous evidence of what of the dynamics between Mr. Keegan and Mr. Tolliver, which is from a status conference before the Milwaukee County Circuit Court on January 6th of 1992. And this was cited in our brief and has been submitted as part of the record. But this was in a request by Mr. Tolliver to have, or really by Mr. Keegan to withdraw his counsel based on Mr. Tolliver's request that he withdraw. And the trial court asked Mr. Tolliver what his problem with Mr. Keegan was. And Mr. Tolliver responded, "He's not following up on leads I have given him. I have got numerous witnesses I have asked his investigator to go to. His investigator won't even budge. I got witnesses. Every time I bring something to him, he tell me that, well, all this and that. To shoot a guy and don't even investigate it, there is witnesses out there still relevant to the case that he ain't even talked to yet." And the trial court then asked Mr. Keegan to respond. Mr. Keegan didn't respond substantively to Mr. Tolliver's concern about witnesses, but he did say, "As far as I know, I have sent the investigator out to talk with everybody that is closely relevant to the case. But Mr. Tolliver and I do see things differently. There is no question about that."
Now, this came to your attention at what point in the litigation?
This came to our attention in the proceedings in the district court.
after our remand.
Correct.
So the proceedings on remand did flesh out the record somewhat with respect to the question of trial counsel's effectiveness. Am I right?
Correct. Well, there was.
You didn't get everything you wanted, but you got some. Well, I should say the parties didn't get everything they wanted, but you got some.
Ideally, we would have had Mr. Keegan's file and some indication of why he did not call. And
didn't we, in our earlier opinion, make it clear that the record as we had it in the first appeal did make out certainly a prima facie case for ineffectiveness?
That's correct, Your Honor.
So we were, you were attempting at this point really to gild the lily. On the remand, you wanted to get more information if you could.
You might want to put it that way.
And I mean, really, the state had, at that point, at least the practical burden of showing that there was some kind of other tactical, some kind of tactical choice that was before the trial defense counsel that we really hadn't been aware of the first time around on this case.
Yes, I think that seemed to be one of the purposes for ordering the hearing, was to allow the state to elicit evidence on why Mr. Keegan made the decision that he did.
We said nothing in the first opinion, did we, about the deficiency of the of Mr. Tolliver's case on the ineffectiveness problem?
No.
I don't, at any point in the opinion.
I mean, as far as the fact that Mr. Keegan trial counsel
was
deceased.
We didn't say to you, your case is deficient in some respect.
Correct. You did not. And the case, or the first case, I think, thoroughly explains why, on first glance, this court found that Mr. Keegan's performance was deficient.
We didn't indicate that Tolliver had overlooked something that he should have brought to the attention of either the state court or our court.
That's correct, Your Honor. And I believe we did buttress the evidence as much as we could by producing in the district court this transcript from the 1992 pretrial conference, which was, as we said, presented to the district court. The district court did not rely on this evidence, but it was before the district court. And importantly, it was also before the state court. This was a transcript that the state court had at its disposal. Of course, the state court did not address prejudice, so it would not have, did not address performance, so it would not have necessarily come up. But to address the court's other question of how do you assess Mr. Keegan's performance when Mr. Keegan has died, well, we do have Mr. Tolliver's testimony, and Mr. Tolliver testified at the evidentiary hearing that he had a discussion with Mr. Keegan about Harvey Tolliver and Angeal Tolliver testifying, and that Mr. Keegan told him that he did not intend to call them as witnesses because of their family connection. So that's Mr. Tolliver's testimony. It's uncontradicted. And I think Mr. Tolliver's testimony is supported by his 1992 statement in the Milwaukee County Circuit Court. I think this is a classic example of a prior consistent statement that would be admissible at a trial and is certainly something this court should consider.
Outside of saying that he and Mr. Tolliver did not see eye to eye, did his trial defense counsel at that early hearing and before the trial court have anything further to say about the question of
he did not. He was asked by the trial court to respond. He declined that other than that brief statement that I provided. He did indicate that he was seeking to withdraw from the case in part because he had another homicide trial scheduled for 2 weeks, I believe, after this homicide trial. So we are able to start to parse together the thinking going on in Mr. Keegan, or at least the dynamics between Mr. Keegan and Mr. Tolliver, when the evidentiary hearing in the district court is combined with this transcript from the state court proceeding. I think that is sufficient right there for Mr. Tolliver to establish that his counsel's performance was deficient. With respect to Harvey Tolliver, we have uncontradicted evidence that Harvey Tolliver was not interviewed by Mr. Keegan. That means that the presumption of reasonableness that Strickland imposes does not apply here. And that is...
The state courts didn't think that was a prejudicial omission, isn't that true?
Well, the state court did not find that Mr. Tolliver was prejudiced by either of these witnesses failing to testify because the state court found that the evidence is overwhelming against Mr. Tolliver. And that's what this court disagreed with.
Well, that's the basis of Mr. Gansner's invocation of Harrington.
Yes, and our position on prejudice is that, first of all, prejudice, this court's decision on prejudice is the law of the case and is entitled to deference.
When there's an intervening Supreme Court decision.
If there's an intervening Supreme Court decision that modifies the law, we do not believe Harrington modifies the law. And even if it does, this court followed Harrington. This court applied the standard that Harrington requires. Just to compare the standard that Harrington imposes with this court's standard that it used in finding prejudice. Harrington stated, prejudice is where, court must determine, a federal court must determine if a state court ruling was so lacking in justification that there was an error well understood and comprehended in existing law beyond any possibility for fair-minded disagreement. Well, this court held that when it's reviewing a state court's determination.
You're missing the significance of Harrington. The significance of Harrington is that there was no state court opinion in that case. And the holding of Harrington is that the standard is not whether the state court gave an adequate explanation for why it declined to grant relief. It's could a reasonable court have believed that there was no basis for relief. So you have to look at the evidence and see whether, the court didn't say anything or didn't say enough, but it could have reasonably believed that there was insufficient a basis for habeas corpus.
And that's one part of Harrington, is even if a state court decision gives a blanket statement affirmed, it is still entitled to deference under AEDPA. But this court provided the state court decision deference. It was clear that it was applying deference both through Strickland and through the AEDPA requirements. And this court said that it would only find prejudice and disagree with the state court if the state court's decision was lying well outside the boundaries of permissible differences of opinion. I think that substantively is no different than the standard that was stated by the Supreme Court. I think substantively, this court applied the standard that was used in Harrington. And this court also found in Sussman versus Jenkins, which was decided shortly after Harrington, that Harrington did not change the playing field as far as how this court is to review state court decisions. The court in Sussman denied the state's motion to stay the mandate pending a cert petition in light of Harrington and Pinholster. And I think the same analysis that was done in Sussman applies to the case here as far as how Harrington applies. The court was clear that it was deferring to the state court decision on prejudice, but it was an unreasonable decision for the reasons that were stated in the court's opinion. And the court followed the Harrington rule in analyzing what is the best argument for the state court's opinion. Well,
what the court said in Harrington is stronger than what you have in your paraphrase. And if there is no possibility fair-minded jurists could disagree with the state court's decision. Right? That's very strong. So can we say that no fair-minded jurist would disagree with the conclusion that Tolliver wasn't prejudiced by the absence of his wife's testimony or whatever Harris might have come up with?
Yes, in the context of this case and in the context of Mr. Tolliver's defense, which the defense was that he did not intend to kill Tina Rogers or to have his brother kill Tina Rogers. He was the only witness who provided evidence that he did not state kill the bitch. That was an important issue in the case, was whether he said kill the bitch or you done killed the bitch. Mr. Tolliver stated he said to his brother, you done killed the bitch. That is huge as far as what Mr. Tolliver's intent was. And the other witnesses, Angeal Tolliver was the only witness who would have corroborated Mr. Tolliver's testimony that he did not say, you done killed the bitch. And Angeal Tolliver would have corroborated that
by... You mean that he said, you done?
Yes.
Yeah.
And Angeal would have corroborated Mr. Tolliver's testimony by providing a prior and consistent statement from Joetta Foster, who was one of the witnesses who said, kill the bitch. So I think in the context of Mr. Tolliver's defense, where he had no other witnesses, he was the only witness, and these two witnesses were directly essential to the defense of negating his intent to kill Ms. Rogers. I think in that context, and reading the state court's opinion, it really had no concept of what Mr. Tolliver's defense was. What the state court concluded was, well, he had a gun, he assisted his brother, or he recruited his brother to bring Ms. Rogers back to the house. He said to Mr. Thompson, who was the person whose money was missing and who was kind of the ringleader of this whole thing, well, if you think I took the money, shoot me or shoot whoever took the money. And the state found that was beyond a reasonable doubt or beyond any comprehension or any doubt that it was evidence of first-degree intentional homicide. And this court reasonably found that that was not a reasonable determination of Mr. Tolliver's defense, and that's what takes the case out of the area of a permissible or reasonable disagreement into an unreasonable decision by the state court.
Okay. Thank you.
I have nothing further.
Thank you. Mr. Gansner?
Very briefly, to address a factual matter that was just a subject of questioning by the court. On the significance of the Angeal Tolliver's non-presented testimony, had Angeal Tolliver testified, according to the defense, she would have testified that another witness had said something different than that witness had testified for the state during trial. The other witness was Joetta Foster, who was one of the witnesses to the shooting, to the killing, the execution of Tina Rogers. Ms. Foster at trial had testified that she heard the defendant, Stephen Tolliver, say after one gunshot had been fired, she testified that she heard Stephen Tolliver say to his brother, who had actually fired the shot, shoot the bitch. Another shot was then fired. Angeal Tolliver provided an affidavit that said she had a subsequent conversation with Joetta Foster in which Joetta Foster said, well, actually I said something. What I remember hearing was something a little bit different. And the defense's argument is, had they been able to present that, it would have shown her trial testimony to be inconsistent. But what Angeal Tolliver said, she would testify, Joetta Foster said she really heard having said, was,
okay, thank you, Mr. Gansner.
Shoot the bitch, you shot the bitch, or something like that.
Your time has expired.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you to both counsel. This will be taken under advisement.